It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Now, from the most powerful city in the world, a new generation of conservative talk. Fair, fresh, fun. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
Welcome into Friday, March 24th, 2023. I'm Guy Benson. You're listening to the Guy Benson Show every weekday, 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern. So glad that you're here. Thank you for listening. GuyBensonShow.com is our website, all sorts of resources there about the program, including the free podcast every day on demand, totally free of charge. The lineup today here on the radio, Shannon Bream will join us here in studio in just a few minutes. She's the anchor of Fox News Sunday. I'll be on the panel on Fox News Sunday. Check your local listings day after tomorrow. We will also have a guest telling us about a very important election in Wisconsin that you may not have heard of. But it's a big one. We'll explain. That's later in the show. Jerry Willis also here talking about some new worries and jitters around the bank crisis and Deutsche Bank. And where do we go from here? The Fed actions this week, plus her new podcast, which sounds fascinating. That's in our final hour. Our colleague Jerry Willis at Fox Business Network. I'm a political editor at townhall.com. I'm also a Fox News contributor. If you're new, I just like to reintroduce myself from time to time. We're just very thrilled and delighted that you are here with us. I'm looking up at my TV screen right now. And just to let you know, just a heads up, President Biden is currently addressing Parliament up in Ottawa, in Canada. And he is currently getting a standing ovation from both sides of the aisle. I've seen a few shots of Prime Minister Trudeau nodding along, clapping along with President Biden, saying that we are two nations with one shared heart, which is a nice sentiment. And our allies up to the north hearing from our president today. So if there's any very big news that comes out of this, I kind of doubt it. This is a canned speech. But if there is big news coming out of this, we'll let you know. President Biden in Ottawa today. Now, speaking of Biden, I actually want to start by talking about him and his vice president, because there's a Reuters story by Jeff Mason and one of his colleagues that's gotten some attention in the last day or so. The headline is "Tethered Together, Biden and Harris Move Toward 2024 Re-election Run." And a lot of the thrust is the story of the story, rather, is basically about how Biden is more or less stuck with her. But there are a few quotes from current and former White House officials that do at least hint at some significant tensions and dissension within the ranks in the Democratic Party about the future and the role of Vice President Harris in particular. So it's one story. So take that with a grain of salt. But let me read to you a few passages from the Reuters report. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris may not have won over America in her first 2 years in office, but she is staying put at President Joe Biden's side. And that is a very kind way of putting it, by the way. May not have won over America. That is true. She has not. The first woman vice president is gearing up for another national campaign despite low poll ratings, a failure to win over the Washington establishment, and concern among fellow Democrats about an underwhelming start in the job. Harris heads into a high-pressure situation as Biden, now 80, moves toward an unprecedented run for a second term as the first octogenarian in the Oval Office. He's 80. She's a lot younger. Story goes on. If he wins and becomes ill or cannot fulfill his duties, Harris, 58, would succeed him. That reality will hang over their 2024 re-election bid. Yes, it will. Just as an aside for me, Biden has had a bad term in office. We'll talk about some of his approval numbers here in a second. And he is old and he looks old. And he sounds old a lot of the time. And it's impossible, I think, for voters to look at this guy and say, six more years as president? Is that realistic? And if not, who would be waiting in the wings constitutionally? Her? I think a lot of voters may not be overly excited about that prospect. Back to the Reuters story. While the pair have a good working relationship, Democratic sources say Biden has frustrations about some of her work. He is also convinced that neither Harris nor any other Democratic hopeful would be able to beat former President Donald Trump if he is the Republican nominee, a factor that has influenced Biden's inclination to run again, one former White House official said. So Biden's frustrated with his vice president. He's frustrated with Harris, but he also looks at her and the rest of the potential field and is like, oh, I don't think they can win. And at least that's what they're telling people is one of the driving forces behind what is now widely expected to be a reelection campaign. I don't know when they'll announce it. They keep saying, you know, it's his intent. They'll announce it soon. We'll see. They'll get around to it at some point, I guess. Now, here's one of these officials speaking on the condition of anonymity to Reuters. If he did not think she was capable, he would not have picked her. But it is a question of consistently rising to the occasion. I think his running for re-election is less about her, more about him. But I do think she and the Democratic bench are a factor. Interesting. Flipping pages here. It's a pretty long story. A couple different Democratic sources note, quote, the implausibility of replacing Harris on the presidential ticket. And this is now quoting someone. It's almost impossible for them to make a change. Biden could lose crucial votes if he were to drop Harris, who is both the first black and first Asian American U.S. vice president. And the first female vice president. You cannot replace your first black woman vice president and think that black people and women are going to just vote for you, a former White House official said. He needs her, speaking of Biden. So they're kind of stuck in that sense. Now, what are these frustrations that people are talking about? Because that's what the headline is. When people and journalists and commentators are reacting to the Reuters story, the number one news hook is the alleged reported angst that Biden and some others are feeling about her performance. Some who work or have worked in the West Wing say Harris's engagement on policy was lacking. Quote, a point of tension in their relationship is that I don't think the president sees her as somebody who takes anything off of his plate, another former White House official said, adding that, quote, a fear of messing up had led Harris to be late to the game on important issues. So, again, I mean, they could be a lot more blunt, I would say, than that. But they're saying there's some frustration. She hasn't taken anything off his plate. There's then pushback from people in her camp saying, well, actually, she's a big warrior on abortion, which Biden doesn't want to talk about as much because he's Catholic. I mean, he talks about it a lot, and he takes a position that, let's just say, does not even come close to aligning with Catholic doctrine on the issue or even just mainstream American views on the issue of abortion. He's now become a total radical. So, I mean, the fact that she's talking about it or is more the face of that radicalism, I don't know if that's a huge boon to them, given her lack of popularity, but that's at least the way that they're framing it. They're spinning it, Kamala's camp. And then at the end of the story, they mention, of course, her role at the border. Border czar, which has just become really a punchline. Because, I mean, it is a catastrophic, historic crisis. And she has done absolutely nothing. She went down there for a box-checking visit where she didn't even go to a busy sector, didn't do anything of substance. And then Biden eventually had to do the same thing. Didn't see a single illegal migrant while he was down there. But they gave her that role in her portfolio, border czar, and the allies of Harris are trying to that really that wasn't her brief. It's unfair to say that her job was to deal with the border crisis. They say her remit was to focus on Central America, not border security as a whole. So they're trying to kind of tweak what the assignment was to say it's not really her fault, which I'm sure also to some extent ticks off folks at the White House and the people that are being quoted talking about how Biden feels like she's not actually helping on anything of significance, especially if you've got her people telling reporters, well, the thing, the big thing that I was charged with isn't really the thing that I was charged with. Now, she's allowing others to say that on her behalf, but that's been part of the angle that they've taken now for a while, which you kind of understand because it's been such an unmitigated debacle, this a total cataclysmic failure of policy. I would argue an intentional one. If you felt like your political brand were attached to it and you had been assigned this thing to worry about and to focus on and to fix, you would want to do everything within your power to distance yourself from the results, which is what she's trying to do, which only feeds into, you would imagine, some of these frustrations. So the fact that the quotes are coming from various current and especially former White House officials, you kind of wonder, did the White House authorize this? Did they want to send a message that Biden isn't totally thrilled with Harris? Could that be some sort of prelude to him figuring out a way to drop her from the ticket? I don't think so. Because even though there are criticisms and even though there are negative comments, they are relatively tepid. They're not going nuclear on her the way some of these other stories and anonymous sources have in the not-so-distant past. This is mild stuff, comparatively. And one of the main themes of the story is that Biden really can't get rid of her for identity-related reasons. And I think that is what is so revealing about all of this. No one is really trying to make the case that he needs her because of the job that she does or the important areas that she oversees within the administration or her contributions to speaking forcefully on behalf of the administration or being an effective leader, let's say, in a liaison to Capitol Hill or someone who really understands policy inside out. It's not a substantive argument about why they need to keep her. No one is even attempting to make that argument. The whole argument is, well, she's the first this and the first that and the first that. And how can you really cut someone like that loose? That's it. It's an identity politics dilemma. And when I read some of these comments from people saying, well, you know, privately, Biden's frustrated because, you know, she's a vulnerability and she doesn't take anything off his plate and voters might not like this idea of her succeeding him if he can't go on as president, whatever. It's like, you knew all of this. You knew your age, sir, when you first decided to run. You knew your age when you won the nomination. You knew how old you would be if you wanted to seek re-election. And you knew all of the many shortcomings of Kamala Harris that are so obvious and often cringeworthy that Democratic voters overwhelmingly rejected her so comprehensively as a presidential candidate in 2019 that she didn't even make it to 2020 and the Iowa caucuses. She was out before then. She had a big splashy introduction, a big speech in Oakland, California, got a lot of buzz, checked a lot of the potential boxes, and then flopped massively as a candidate because she's not good. She's the drama. She has huge staff turnover. People aren't loyal to her because she's difficult to work for. She's kind of a lightweight on policy and other things. I mean, she's just not a great political talent. She took some pointed shots at Biden during the campaign. They knew all of this, and they picked her anyway 100% because of identity reasons. And now they are, to use the headline from Reuters, tethered together. Even though it sounds like a lot of Democrats would be very happy for him to pick someone else, if it's going to be him, they'd love it to be someone else, but they're tethered together for the same exact reasons. If she becomes a huge political liability in the campaign, there's no one for Biden and his team to blame but themselves. They knew exactly what she was, and they selected her anyway for reasons that did not deal with her qualifications or her talent or her knowledge or any of that stuff. And now they've got a problem on their hands, and they're just sort of like, well, I guess we've got to stick with the problem and double down on it because we can't tick off these little identity groups, because that's the major ethos these days of Democratic left-wing politics. Identity, identity, identity. Now, how's that going for them? We'll talk about the polling numbers, a few new ones just out in the last couple of days. It's not quite a horror show, but it's close. It's very ugly for Biden-Harris. We'll get into that as soon as we come back. It's the Guy Benson Show.
Fresh conservative talk. Guy Benson Show.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
So today, I applaud China for stepping up. Excuse me, I applaud Canada. You can tell what I'm thinking.
So during Women's History Month, we celebrate and we honor the women who made history throughout history.
Here's the dream team. Your president and vice president of the United States of America, President Biden in Canada. Just a little slip, but makes a lot of them. Saluting China, and then he meant Canada. Big laugh from the crowd. And then, of course, Harris. So eloquent as always. Well spoken, Madam Vice President. Well, should play that again. Women's History Month. Tell us, Kamala.
So during Women's History Month, we celebrate and we honor the women. Who made history throughout history.
Throughout history. God, okay. Yep, good. Good stuff. So they're charging toward a re-election, those two. At least a re-election attempt. And I'll talk in the next hour about the Republican Party. Seems to me like the Republican Party should be doing everything in its power, and this means the voters, everything in its power to win the election next year. Putting the best possible ticket up against the people that we just heard from there, who you would think should be actually pretty easy to beat, but they might not be, especially depending on who the Republicans put up. Americans are looking at the performance of that dynamic duo in office right now, and they are not impressed. A new poll from Monmouth University this week shows Biden's approval rating at just 41%, which is actually fantastic compared to Harris's job approval rating in the same poll, 36%, just over 1 in 3 approve of her job performance as VP. And of course, she could become, in the blink of an eye, the beat of a heart, the president of the United States.
We did
She's 36%. He's 41%. It's not a great picture. New poll from the Associated Press has Biden near his all-time lows as president, dipping back in the 30s, 38% approval. Again, these guys should be pretty easy to beat. But will that actually play out in reality? I think Republican voters have some important choices to make, and I'll expand on those thoughts in a bit. But first, Shannon Bream joins us in studio when we return.
You're listening to a new generation of talk, Guy Benson.
We're back. It's the Guy Benson Show. Thanks for being here. So there's some breaking news that DA Alvin Bragg in Manhattan has received a death threat and a package with some unidentified white powder with a note saying that whoever sent it was going to kill Alvin Bragg. And this comes on the same day as former President Trump putting out a series of attacks against Bragg, unsurprisingly, but one of them was this little sort of Photoshop type thing, a meme of Trump holding a baseball bat near Alvin Bragg's head and warning of, quote, death and destruction if an indictment came down. This, of course, on the heels of Trump talking about the need for big protests if an indictment were to happen. I don't even want to be talking about this, right? Like, we have talked on this show now for days and days about how weak the case is in New York against Trump, how Alvin Bragg is way out over his skis, obviously for political reasons, rejecting the very clear cue given to him by the feds and other investigators who did not take up this case. And Republicans are rallying to Trump's side. Even a lot of progressives are saying there's no good case. This is not a good decision. The momentum, at least on this case, seems to be on Trump's side. And yet, Trump can't help himself by going too far and death and destruction, the baseball bat, and you know, now the media is going to have a field day with the death threat. Like, just let the facts in this case speak for themselves. The facts, I think, are on Trump's side. So I just want to bring you that breaking news and then introduce our guest, Shannon Bream, chief legal correspondent here at Fox News, also anchor of Fox News Sunday. Check your local listings. I will be on the panel this coming
weekend.
Can't
wait.
Looking forward to that. She has her podcast, Living the Bream. She's a best-selling author. Another book coming out soon, March 28th. So, I mean, a matter of days, of next Tuesday, I believe,
it
right?
Is, yes.
The Love Stories of the Bible Speak, Biblical Lessons on Romance, Friendship, and Faith. It's great to see you.
Are we still celebrating your birthday? I feel like it can last for weeks at a time.
Yeah, but it's been...
How many?
Yeah, March 7th, so it's
still
been...
your birthday month.
It's birthday month.
Okay, good.
So I'll allow it.
Okay, I'm glad you're with us Sunday. We'll celebrate on the show.
All right. Sounds good. And the book coming out on Tuesday,
yes.
As I mentioned, just a few days away. Just want to give us a little summary real quick. I know your first two installments of this mm-hmm. series have done very well.
Yeah.
Tell us about this one.
So, you know, a lot of what we hear about romance and about marriage, people think, the Bible's not really the place I'm going to go for that. But there's actually a lot there. There are beautiful stories of sacrifice. And we think about Mary and Joseph and Ruth and Boaz. And there's some really good ones. There's some messes like Samson and Delilah. But you know me, if you've read any of my books, you know I like to keep the messy ones in there, too, because I think there are lessons. But I do talk about friendship and this tricky part of the Bible that says you have to love your neighbor as yourself, and there are no exceptions. So I think given the current climate, we could all do more of that.
I would agree. And as you were arriving in the studio, I was just talking a little bit about this breaking news, a death threat against Alvin Bragg, mm-hmm. And then this meme that Trump had posted on Truth Social with the baseball bat and the death and destruction language. And it's just like, look, it's frustrating to me because I think on the merits – it's a very bad look for Bragg. He might have a problem with his grand jurors at this point. It's helping Trump. And if you're a Trump fan, you just want to be like, just, you know, stand back and let some of this play out. And then when you start talking about some of this violent language and then this happens and the threat and the calls for protest, there are some images that mm-hmm. crop up from 2021.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems... to me, it just seems self-destructive. I know a lot of people love that Trump fights, but there's smart fighting and then there's mm-hmm. something other than that. And this seems totally unnecessarily counterproductive.
Yeah, don't give your critics ammo because they're going to have plenty anyway. They're going to look for things and find things. So when they expect you to say something like, yeah, get out there and protest and there might be, quote, death and destruction and the baseball bat meme, I mean, none of that stuff is good for you. Like you said, I think this is probably among the weakest legal cases for him. And based on the testimony of Robert Costello last week, the 2018 letter from Michael Cohen that's popped up, I mean, the grand jury seems to be on a bit of a pause. We don't know what goes on. It's a secret proceeding.
Right.
But it appears it was moving in a positive direction, potentially for the president, former president. So when you do all these other things, the good news for you gets lost in the shuffle because immediately your critics are going to think of January 6th. They're going to go back to all of those places. And maybe it's that, listen, he is a monster in the polls. He is killing it. He is killing the field. And so he may just be feeling very confident that, you know, what did he say in his first campaign for the presidency that, you know, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and still win. People would vote for me. Maybe that's what he's feeling these days.
Yeah, except he lost his most recent election.
Well, I should say, I think that was his first campaign.
It was.
But he did win.
I'm saying, you know, it's not – the country is not so enamored of him that they will vote for him no matter what
right.
because they had an opportunity to vote for him for reelection after a pretty good presidency in a lot mm-hmm. of ways. And they picked this other guy who's I talked about at the start of the show instead. So just
– take your wins where you can get them.
Yeah.
I would say that to any candidate. Take your wins where you can get them.
Right, and don't shoot yourself in the foot. Speaking of mm-hmm. shooting someone, don't just fire it into your own toes
yeah. mm-hmm.
totally unnecessarily. I do have to say, though, because you were talking about the weakness of this case in New York, and it's one of three or four cases out there potentially against Trump. I saw that, I guess, weighing in from prison is Michael Avenatti, who's saying that Michael Cohen, Trump's longtime sort of hatchet man, lawyer, body
These two guys.
They're like, Avenatti from prison is saying that Michael Cohen's a hack and terrible and not credible and all this stuff, which I think is true, but consider the source.
This is a man who's going to be behind bars for a long time for his own problems with veracity. And I think he's really getting at Alvin Bragg, as many on the left are saying, like, listen, you can't pin this whole case on Cohen because either he was lying then or he's lying now. That could raise some doubt in the grand jurors' minds. And you got to weigh that. You don't want to build your entire indictment of Trump on somebody that, listen, when he gets on the witness stand, could be impeached as a witness. There are going to be, listen, whoever's defending President Trump.
All the guy's done is lie forever, Michael Cohen. It's like
either one way or the other. I mean, he's been lying then or lying now. I mean, that's a provable fact.
Or some of both, right?
You can't be telling the truth in all these cases. So if the president is indicted, if he faces a trial, his defense team is going to have a field day with Michael Cohen. And that's why so many on the left are like, don't do this, Alvin Bragg, because if you tee this thing up, don't get a prosecution, it's going to look totally political.
Because it is, right?
If you don't get a conviction,
Or even if the indictment itself would be political. I mean, the feds, who are more than
they said no thanks.
They said no thanks based on the facts, based on the evidence or lack thereof. And again, this is why, coming back to the point, I think at least on this case, things were moving in a very uncomfortable direction for Alvin Bragg and maybe even the Democrats, and a favorable one for Trump for a number of reasons, because he's in the spotlight, people are rallying to him, which is why he's got this lead in the polls right now. And it's just like the self-destructive impulse to then just go that extra step or two farther, which some people will absolutely love. The hardcore base of Trump will love that sort of thing. That's why they love him. But a lot of other people will say, dude, what are you doing?
Like, and it reminds them of listen, even if they loved his policies toward the end of that first term, how they were getting so frustrated with having to defend him all the time and feeling like he was snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. So I do think it will remind some people who are like, yeah, I could, you know, I'd love to have him back. I could deal with some of his policies. I love those. I love the judges, whatever. But I didn't want to deal with all of the chicanery that came along with that. And he's reminding them now, listen, I can, like you said, for some people who are huge Trump supporters, they love this. This is what gets their fire going, and it's why they're absolutely going to vote for him again.
Yep. And then there's another group of Republicans. And then separate from that, a bunch of independents who ultimately choose whoever the president's going to be. Right?
That's small section.
To bear in mind, interesting day here in Washington yesterday, Shannon, up on Capitol Hill, the TikTok CEO, seems like there's some pretty broad agreement that it did not go well for him or for TikTok. What were some of your impressions of what we saw on the Hill yesterday, and what might the ramifications be moving forward here for TikTok? Because I actually see some journalists saying that this is all xenophobia and Congress is, you know, they have no evidence. And it's like, it seems like American journalists are carrying the water for TikTok more aggressively than TikTok is carrying the water for TikTok.
Well, listen, there are so few things we know, especially right now in Washington, where there's bipartisan agreement. There is bipartisan agreement on the threat of China to the U.S. And there's also bipartisan agreement, it seems like, on the Hill in the Senate and the House that they don't think TikTok is a good thing. They think it's actually a national security threat. And there were some videos that they played in the hearing yesterday. If you missed those, you weren't paying attention because some of them were very violent and very specific. And that's why lawmakers said, hey, check this out. How do you explain this? And it put him in a really tough position. You know, there are all kinds of questions. And he said, we're spending $1.5 billion creating this firewall so that no U.S. data or information will be accessible by other companies or other countries. But there's this 2017 law in China that says basically the government there, which is a communist-run government, can have access to things that go on with companies that are based there. So I don't think he convinced a lot of folks. There's legislation. There are competing pieces of legislation, but none of them are good for TikTok.
ByteDance is this parent company, right, which is based in China and therefore completely beholden to the CCP. You can't do business in China, especially as a Chinese company, without the full blessing of the Chinese Communist Party, the regime in China. So, I mean, with all due respect to them, they can come out and try to make us ooh and ah about a billion-plus-dollar firewall.
And he does say we're a private company over and over again, but that doesn't mean the same thing in China that it means in America.
Correct. And the firewall ultimately could be pretty useless or toothless and just like done for appearance's sake. Mm-hmm. I don't trust that at all. Mm-hmm. And you're right. It was striking and almost refreshing how usually at hearings, especially recently, it feels like you can close your eyes, have no idea who's talking, but you can tell which side they're on almost immediately because of the tone, because of the talking points. It's just sort of like a big show, a big partisan show where each side goes back and forth. That wasn't really the case yesterday. There were really tough pointed questions being asked by both sides of the aisle where you could, again, close your eyes and not be sure if it was a Republican or a Democrat. And the TikTok CEO, I guess, did his best, but he's got tough facts. Mm-hmm. He's got the guy sitting over his shoulder who's done some weird apology stuff for the CCP and their genocide and that sort of thing. So, I mean, it was a rarity in D.C. and probably one that was pretty well earned.
Well, and you have other people like Congressman Bowman, who is out there saying it's racist. As you said, there's some people saying it's xenophobic to go after them. But he also said, listen, if you're worried about private data, we have U.S.-based companies like Facebook, Twitter, whatever you want to reference that also potentially presents a privacy threat or something that is harmful to your kids.
Sure.
So they're trying to say, well, you're just picking on them because of a, you know, xenophobic issue. If you really cared about privacy, you'd be after all of the social media companies and apps.
Well, I think it's fair to raise some of those questions about privacy. There's a difference between U.S. companies and companies controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. Mm-hmm. And it's not racist or xenophobic to say that. I know they tried this with COVID, too. Any criticism of China, interestingly, a certain group of people say that's racist. And that makes me, let's just put it this way, extremely suspicious of those people. Because the number one victim of the Chinese Communist Party are Chinese people and Asians and minorities. Mm-hmm. So the typical song and dance about identity politics and xenophobia and racism – doesn't apply unless you're just being a useful stooge or worse for the Chinese Communist Party. I'm not making that allegation against Congressman Bowman. He might just be a fool. But you raise my antenna if you're trying to lay that sort of framing on top of what should be something that we agree on and that we cooperate on. And generally, I feel like that's what is happening in D.C.
I do think for the most part on this issue, for sure. And did you see the piece, though, that was in the Washington Post by the Chinese dissident who said, if you get rid of TikTok, if you wipe it out in some way, there are all kinds of concerns. He says, I use it to communicate with people who are inside. He says, there are ways that I can get to people inside China by routing things through different servers in different countries to give them the truth. He says, the problem with young people in China is they don't know what the outside world is. They don't know what the truth is because obviously they're just indoctrinated with what their government wants them to do.
Right.
Now, what that has to do with us getting rid of it here in America, I don't know, but that's one of your media pieces out there.
Shannon, I want to play you this. I played the clip a couple times this week. Our colleague Peter Ducey asking a question to the White House press secretary about the Biden family and payments from China. The answer then the question, cut 24.
House oversight says they've got bank records showing a Chinese energy company paying three Biden family members through a third party. What were they paid for?
Look, I'm just not going to respond to that from here. Look, we have heard from House Republicans for years and years and years how the inaccuracies and lies when it comes to this issue. And I don't even know where to begin to even answer that question, because again, it's been lies and lies and inaccuracy for the past couple years, and I'm just not going to get into it from here.
She doesn't even know where to begin on that question from Peter Ducey. I said answer then question, of course, is the question, then the answer from her, a non-answer, a defiant non-answer, citing years of lies and inaccuracies. To my ears, it's a completely fair question from Ducey based on documentation, and the answer from the White House is, we're just not going to engage, sorry, lies or something.
I don't know what else they do, though, because think about that was the line with the laptop. That was always the line. This is Russian disinformation.
Right.
And we pressed like, okay, but But there are people who are parties to some of these emails who have come on our air. You think about Bobulinski with Tucker to say, I'm the person who's copied on this email, or I'm providing you my version, mm-hmm. my copy, my side of the email, that these things are legit. So you notice that they never said from the White House podium that stuff is all completely false. Not single one of those emails is real. They're all doctors. It was much more broad and vague, like, hey, this is probably a Russian disinformation campaign. So to say now, instead of addressing these exact documents, like, okay, we'll have an explanation for you on that. To say, like, well, there have just been so many lies, I don't know where to start. Well, why don't you start with this lies. One document?
Or with your lies about Russian disinformation, which was a big lie. Shannon, we're almost up on a break that we've got to take just very quickly. Sunday, Fox mm-hmm. News Sunday, excited to be on the panel. Who else is on the program?
So House Foreign Affairs Committee Chair Michael McCaul is with us, given what's happening in Syria, China, Russia, Ukraine. We've got plenty to discuss with him. We're also going to do a deep dive legal panel with Jonathan Turley, Trey Gowdy, and the political implications with Britt Hume. And then you join us to discuss a plethora of the day's news.
Can't wait. Shannon Bream, check your local listings on Sunday, then the replay on Fox News Channel. That's the day after tomorrow on Fox. Can't wait.
See them. Birthday celebrations.
Yes, absolutely. Great to see you, Shannon. We'll be right back.
The Guy Benson Show. More next.
Welcome back to The Guy Benson Show. We were just mentioning Shannon Bream's forthcoming book. Some other book news here in Foxland. Very, very excited for Benjamin Hall, whose memoir, Saved, we had him on the show here. He's giving a lot of really moving, dynamic interviews. That book has hit the bestseller list in the New York Times at number one, outselling a bunch of really impressive people and big titles. Saved by Benjamin Hall, number one, New York Times. Good for him. He deserved it. He's earned it. A really gripping story. And then, also somewhat relatedly, I got in the mail yesterday my advanced copy of Kat Timpf's new book coming out soon. You can't joke about that. I started it last night. I'm already four chapters deep. She just lets it all hang out in this book. She is not pulling punches. She is not hiding anything about her past. I learned some things. Also very funny too. So I can't wait to talk to her about that very soon. Another hour coming up on the Guy Benson Show. Please stay with us. We'll be right back after this.
From the most powerful city in the world, unconventional talk from a fresh, unconventional conservative, Guy Benson Show.
A fresh hour is here on the Guy Benson Show on this Friday. Thank you for listening. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast is free on demand every day when the show is over. Also, follow us on social media at Guy Benson Show, Twitter and Instagram. We've got some bonus content there. I'll also remind you on the podcast side, bonus Benson on the weekends. Big one out tomorrow that you don't want to miss. Fox News alert as we enter our second hour of three. The Dow up at the close, 132 points in the green, finishing the week at 32,238. Well, there's an election coming up in the state of Wisconsin, which is perhaps the most closely divided battleground state in the country. It's top three for sure. And this is a race involving the state Supreme Court, which are elected seats. And it is a knife's edge race in a closely divided court that could have huge implications for that state, which matters nationally, for the next several years. And it's sort of flying under the radar. I know we've talked about the Chicago mayor runoff, which is interesting. That's in early April. But I want to make sure that we're also paying attention to this contest in the Badger State. And with me now to help explain what's at stake, who's running, how things are going right now, is Scott Manley. He's Executive Vice President of Government Relations at Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, WMC, a great organization. It's the state's largest business association up in Wisconsin, and he's been following this very, very closely. Scott, it is great to talk to you.
Great to be on. Thanks for having me, Guy, and hopefully we can get you back into the North Woods in our beautiful northern Wisconsin again.
just a beautiful place. I had a great time with you guys last year. Well, just lay this out for our audience. What's happening in this race? Who are the key players in this race? When is the election? What's at stake in Wisconsin?
So the election is April 4th. We have a seven-member Supreme Court right now, and conservatives currently have a 4-3 majority, but one of those conservatives is retiring, so we've got an open seat. And so whoever wins is going to, you know, whichever side wins is going to have the ideological majority on this court. We've got on the conservative side a former Supreme Court Justice, Dan Kelly, who had been appointed by Scott Walker, running. And then on the liberal side, we have Janet Protasiewicz, who is a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge. And really what's at stake, Guy, is many, if not all, of the incredible reforms that Wisconsin was able to enact over, 8 years of Scott Walker being one of the most consequential reform governors in America. But I would argue that, and certainly the Democrats nationally are saying, that the control of Congress is at stake in this race, because the liberal candidate, Janet Protasiewicz, is saying, if you elect me, I will overturn the redistricting maps in Wisconsin. And there are two seats in Wisconsin right now that are very, very sort of toss-up seats that Republicans hold on to. And it wouldn't take much in changing those maps to give the Democrats two additional seats in Congress after the 2024 elections. And I mean, Speaker McCarthy has a 9-vote majority right now. So, obviously he wants to grow that. He doesn't want to lose ground. And this Supreme Court race in Wisconsin could, if it goes the wrong way, could almost ensure that Republicans will lose ground in Congress.
Yep. I mean, lose ground ideologically. There could be some major pieces of reform legislation that an activist court could just throw out, and they make no bones about being activists. These are elected positions. She's promising to fiddle with the congressional maps, election rules heading into the next presidential election in a very important state. Having a liberal Supreme Court versus a conservative one could have national ramifications. Then, of course, just all the state level issues. I know the left is leaning into abortion and other things like that. There's just a lot on the table right now, not just for Wisconsin, but potentially nationally as well, as you mentioned, Congress and even the presidential election and some of these matters that could come before this extremely closely divided court. And the next opening, the next potential opportunity to flip a seat wouldn't come until 2025, I believe. It would go a lefty is going to be retiring. So the next few years of jurisprudence in Wisconsin coming down to this extremely important statewide Supreme Court race in Wisconsin, which is why I'm giving it some national attention. It's not just some, small local parochial issue. There are implications elsewhere. You just told us about who the candidates are, and one of them's a liberal, one of them's a conservative. I think it's pretty clear. We've seen the left very highly motivated all around the country, turning out in some of these types of races in very big numbers. Wisconsin is always a turnout battle. Your Democratic governor narrowly won re-election last year, but the Republican U.S. Senator, Ron Johnson, rather, also narrowly won re-election. I mean, it's just a few votes here or there can make the difference in your state, as you well know, Scott. So tell us where this race stands at the moment. Is the public polling reliable? I know you guys follow races like this. You understand the state like the back of your hand. How is this thing shaping up right now?
Well, it's a close race. I think that we're, according to our own polling, which we don't typically release, but we actually did with the poll that we did on Monday of this week, and it shows that the liberal candidate is leading by 2 points, which is actually kind of amazing, Guy, because the money, the millions and millions and millions of dollars that have been pouring into Wisconsin from mostly California and New York billionaires like Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, he's already given at least $2 million that's been reported so far for this race. The fact that we're only 2 points back and we have been just dramatically outspent by Democrats and the left is actually kind of amazing. And I think it speaks to not only the quality of Dan Kelly as a strong candidate, but the weakness of Janet Protasiewicz, who's just an absolutely radical liberal judge who's got a record, and we've been running millions of dollars of our own ads to tell this
story.
Soft
on crime is a big one, right? She's been awful on crime.
It's huge. Time after time after time, Guy, you have child predators coming before her in court who have committed unspeakable crimes against children, and she gives probation. I mean, it's just, it's crazy.
And yet you have, like, huge gobs of money coming in from the coast to try to flip this Supreme Court, and there's a lot at stake. Look, these leftists aren't cutting giant checks for no reason. They understand there's a lot at stake, which is why conservatives need to know about this nationally as well. Dan Kelly is the conservative in that race. The election is April the 4th in Wisconsin. The early voting starts on Tuesday, or started on Tuesday, March 21st, just a few days ago. Mail-in absentee ballot must be requested by March 30th. So lots of ways to vote if you're in Wisconsin. And nationally, please pay attention to this. Don't sleep on this race. A big one, April 4th in Wisconsin. Scott Manley, appreciate your time. Thanks for the insights.
Thanks for having me, Guy, and thanks for elevating this race to a national audience.
You bet. We'll be right back. I'm Guy Benson. We're back. It's the Guy Benson Show. If you follow me on social media personally, at Guy P. Benson, you may have seen on Twitter or Instagram a little love note that I got from a fan the other day that I decided to screenshot and then post. And by the way that I cropped it makes it look like it's an iMessage to my iPhone, like a text. This is, in fact, a direct message, a private message on Instagram in the message requests folder, which I only check every so often. And this person had sent me just a bit of fan mail, and he wrote this: "What's worse than a gay conservative?" That was the first message. Promising. Next message: "A gay conservative on Fox News." Third message: middle finger emoji. That was it. That was the whole message. So I looked at that. Usually I ignore, delete, mute, block, something like that. Especially Instagram is like my happier social media place because Twitter's a dumpster fire. But I decided to go high road, so I responded, "I enjoy and respect differences in opinion, proud of who and what I am, and respectful of others' views. Have a nice evening." Did not hear back. So I just posted that. Got a lot of response. A lot of response, including from many of you, listeners coming out of the woodwork to send me notes of encouragement. And I just wanted to address a few things because people were asking me, "Are you going to talk about this on the show? Please talk about this on the show." I honestly wasn't planning on it, but based on the outpouring of response, I decided to actually double down a little bit on my Instagram handle and on my Instagram stories. And I just posted a series of screenshots of me on Fox News. And I said, "Public service announcement, I'm a gay conservative on Fox News, deal with it." With the words attached to a series of screenshots of myself on the channel, on the business network, etc. Just kind of like, "I see your middle finger," and in a very polite way, I reply with my own. Not to you, but to this notion that I shouldn't be this combination of things. So in response to just a few things that I posted about it, I heard from, without exaggeration, dozens and dozens of right-leaning gay people who were just extremely kind, saying, "We're with you, we're here, we see you, thank you for being a public face of this particular small community." And it's true. A lot of LGBT people who are right-leaning face incredible ugliness and nastiness from lefty activists. Not just Democrats or liberals in general. So many of my friends are those things, and they're tolerant and they're fine and we disagree, but they don't go down this nasty little path. But there is a certain brand, there is a certain strain of progressive LGBT angry activist or adjacent to that world who feel like they have to be very brave and call out people who are like traitors to their community or whatever. And it's so exhausting. It's so obnoxious. And I know that this is also probably resonant with people who are, quote unquote, not supposed to be conservative in other ways. Conservative women get this. Conservative racial minorities get this, maybe worse than anyone else. So I know that I'm not the only person who gets this kind of thing. And by the way, I almost never post this stuff. I almost never acknowledge it. I get it all the time. All the time. Like basically every day of my life. Almost always from strangers, occasionally from people that I even know. Like we'll have a few drinks and just start saying stuff. It's like, okay. And I ignore it. I don't publicize it. I'm not looking for attention. I'm not some giant victim. It just comes with the territory, right? People are going to be detractors. They're not going to like you. They're going to disagree with you. If you're in the public eye and you're talking about controversial stuff every day, which is what I do here, you're going to hear from folks who don't necessarily agree with you or support you. And sometimes they'll be, you know, mean and nasty about it. And it is what it is. And I try not to let it get to me. Some of the stuff, when it crosses certain lines, like, can be bothersome to me, but you have to have thick skin. So I don't put it out there because I think it actually bothers Adam, bothers my family. I don't want them to see it. It's just, like, not necessary. And also, I get a ton of really nice stuff, too, from people who listen to the show or watch on TV or like something that I've said. So I get tons of positive reinforcement as well that more than offsets the negative stuff. Although I think the way that the human brain works is sometimes the negative stuff is more likely to stick with you. And I don't go out there like, you know, retweeting or sharing a bunch of the approbation that I get either, right? To me, a lot of it's just people sending notes and that's it. And if you're nice and you're polite, I try to respond. If you're not, I usually don't respond, or occasionally I will, like the way that I did here with this particular message. And the reason that I ultimately decided to not just amplify this a little bit more on social media, but also talk about it here again, is because so many of you, members of this listening audience, almost felt like on my behalf offended and upset and wanted me to know that you guys appreciate me and the show. And I just want to give it right back at you. You know, I'm not talking into a microphone off into some void. I'm talking to many thousands of you every day, live on the air on our affiliates, live through Fox Nation or our streams or all the many ways you can listen, on the podcast. We have a lot of people listening every day, and it means a lot. And because we sort of have this almost radio familial relationship, I appreciate that you're a little bit defensive of me if someone's going to be an a-hole to me. So I just want to say that I'm grateful. Part of the reason that some of this stuff doesn't get to me and doesn't grate on me or eat away at me is because of you guys. And because of so much of the positivity that you bring every day to the radio family. So I just wanted to take the opportunity to say thank you to anyone who reached out, or even if you don't have to, like, I just know you're out there and you listen faithfully, and I appreciate it. And the last point I'll make, in case it wasn't already clear, nobody has the right to tell you what you ought to think because you are a certain identity of some sort, some immutable characteristic about you. No one owns your brain. No one owns your worldview. No one owns your vote We're free-thinking people in a free country. That's what we do here. And I think it's boring and lazy and wrong for people to suggest that, oh, you're somehow a bad fill-in-the-blank if you think differently than what their little narrow world demands of you. Screw that. You owe them nothing. You owe it to yourself to be intellectually honest with yourself and be true to who you are. Not to say that you can't be open to criticism or other ideas and you can change your mind and that's all fine. But just the identity, the weaponized, toxic identity stuff, obviously we reject here. And the episode this week is just another reminder of that. So if you're in that position, if this sounds familiar to you, just I'm right there with you, linking arms. The Guy Benson Show, back after this short break. Stay with us.
Talking about the issues you care about, Guy Benson.
Halfway through the Friday edition of The Guy Benson Show. Glad you're here. Almost to the weekend together. So I addressed this a little bit on yesterday's show. Of course, we took a lot of calls about the Trump-DeSantis feud. We told you about the FoxNews.com story citing research that shows in the last couple weeks it's been a 4-1 margin of Trump attacking DeSantis versus Trump criticizing Biden. Trump is absolutely positively fixated on DeSantis. He seems more upset overall, based on the volume of this stuff, with the governor of Florida than the Manhattan DA, for instance. Certainly, Joe Biden, who's almost like an afterthought, it seems, to President Trump. And from my perspective, I sometimes wonder if it's even worth going down this path. Honestly. Like, Trump's going to say what he's going to say. People who love Trump are going to believe it or tolerate it and amplify it. People who don't like Trump will roll their eyes or be frustrated, and it's just like on and on we go. But I still believe that accuracy and arguments, factual information, are things that still matter to a lot of people. Maybe I'm being naive about that. Maybe I'm Pollyannish about that. But I feel like if those things don't matter, really, then what are we doing here? Why does my job exist? I think that there is an appetite for real information. And for that reason, I've been pushing back. Look, there are arguments to be made in favor of Trump running in 2024. In fact, during our phone calls, we took a lot of calls yesterday, almost an hour's worth of calls from you guys about this spat that I think will only get worse, FYI, between Trump and DeSantis. Our lines were packed. We talked to a lot of you, and some of you are strong Trump supporters, and a few of you are explaining why. The number one thing that we heard, and I hear this a lot from Trump supporters, is we know what he did as president. He has a record as president. And he did this, that, and the other, and it's a great record, so we want more of that. And to a large extent, I agree with those arguments. Now, the DeSantis people would say, well, look at his record in Florida. It's not like Ron DeSantis is just out there saying things and pretending that he's fighting for things or speaking a lot of words but showing no action or results. That is not what he's done in Florida. He has a long record, and it's a record that he's building on right now in the legislative session. But just taking Trump in isolation, you can point to, if you want to strip away some of the personal comportment and the baggage and the drama and the scandals and the claims about a stolen election and January 6th, all the stuff that turn off so many people, and I don't think you can avoid that, by the way, you have to recognize in an election what the American people want and what they don't want. Right? That's the contest. You need more people to vote for you than the other guy. And you can make that easier on yourself or harder on yourself, right? That's part of the choice when it comes to an election and who you nominate. But let's just say for now, you strip away all of that other stuff that's been such a turnoff for so many voters and focus on Trump's record as president. You've got a lot of really strong, compelling things to say. You've got a case to make. look at what Trump did as president. You go down the list. If he were out there beating the drum on that, yes, you can say the Alvin Bragg stuff is nonsense and it would be a disgrace to bring an indictment, and I actually agree with that. Right? I've been making that case here for days now based on the facts, because I'm not a blind, deranged anti-Trump person. You can build that proactive, affirmative case for Trump, and he could do the same thing. But instead, he is just fanatically attacking Ron DeSantis constantly, and he's doing it dishonestly. Right? So that's where I feel like pushback is necessary. I know a lot of you probably think that I'm just like all in for DeSantis for president. I am happy to look at the options and see how everyone performs as a candidate. I haven't made up my decision or my mind yet, but I will tell you that a lot of what's coming out of Florida and DeSantis, I like. And the attacks against the record in Florida that are dishonest, I don't like it when it's from the left, and I don't like it when it's from Trump. The amount of BS, unfair garbage that the left and the media have thrown at Florida and DeSantis over the last 4 years has been dizzying. And we've spent a lot of time on this show fighting back against the left because clearly they view DeSantis as a political threat. They want to destroy him. And they play fast and loose with the truth. They sometimes flagrantly lie. And when they do, we call them out. But like, it's okay all of a sudden if it's Trump doing it. Trump doing almost the exact same thing that the left does. In fact, the left and Trump are like hugging on this one. They're teaming up against DeSantis. So I mentioned, for example, yesterday that in Trump's big thread on Truth Social, he kept talking about how awful Florida was in a lot of ways. How Florida was third worst in the country on, and then he had a bunch of stats like COVID deaths, COVID cases, murders, rapes, that sort of thing. And I pointed out, well, the reason that coincidentally, magically, Florida was supposedly third worst in the country on these things is because Florida is the third biggest state with the third highest population. So if you're going to be moronic and focus on raw numbers, yes, Florida is very likely to come in third place on a lot of things because it's in third place in population. That is not how you draw any sort of cause and effect on policy. It just doesn't make any sense unless you are just clumsily manipulating numbers to try to bash someone, hoping that no one pays attention to context or rationality or how numbers work. But Trump, like a bull in a china shop, is just grabbing onto anything. And he's willing to trash his own adoptive home state and the very impressive record that has been established there just in order to sully and dirty up a potential political opponent. I mean, that's what he's doing. It's obvious. So I sort of debate with myself, is it worth spending time fact-checking stuff? Because often the mainstream media fact-checkers are very annoying and they're tendentious and they're one-sided. And a lot of conservatives just tune them out and they've earned that. I'm not one of them. But like, is it worth taking my time and effort to go through and look at, you know, a dozen claims made by Donald Trump against Ron DeSantis and just explain and expose how it's nonsense? Almost all of the points, actually, either misleading or outright dishonest. Do people care? Or is it just like, this is Trump doing Trump, it doesn't really matter. How do we feel on any given day? And we're just going to go and do that. I think ultimately, actually, it does matter. And the reason I've concluded that, even if it's very naive, I think the 2024 election is exceptionally important and consequential. And if Republicans rush into a bad strategic error and end up doing exactly what the left wants them to do and then lose, there's a lot at stake to be lost. And so whether ultimately Trump prevails or DeSantis or someone else, at least we should be having an honest, candid conversation among ourselves as conservatives about what the truth is, what the stakes are, and who has the best chance of winning. And if you rely on a bunch of provable lies to say that the other guy shouldn't be the nominee, to me, that is telling and revealing and a problem. So I've written at townhall.com today a long piece, like a 10-point fact check of Trump's four-post rant against DeSantis that he put up, what, yesterday or the day before? I mentioned the third-place thing already. I just want to give you a handful of them. If you're interested, you can go read the whole thing. It's a fairly lengthy piece, but not too crazy. It's not unwieldy. You can go to townhall.com. You can look up my byline. It's the piece that I wrote today. Came out this morning. I won't go point by point by point all 10 points. What I will say is a couple things here. Trump, in calling Ron DeSanctimonious an average governor, says that Trump, he's boasting that he got 1.2 million more votes than DeSantis did in Florida. Okay. This is, again, playing very stupid games, frankly, with raw numbers, just like he was doing with the other stats. Apples to oranges. Presidential elections have much larger turnouts than midterm elections. That's just how it works. So, yes, a lot more people voted for Trump and against Trump in Florida in a presidential election because it's a huge turnout election. So if that's the barometer, if that's the metric, it's like, oh, well, I won 1.2 million more votes than DeSantis, therefore mine is more impressive. I mean, it seems elementary, but let's talk about why that is just a very misleading, weak argument. Trump beat Hillary Clinton by a little over a point in 2016 in Florida. Then he beat Joe Biden by a little over 3 points 4 years later in 2020. I would say that Hillary and Biden are both very bad candidates, by the way, for various reasons. Different reasons, both bad candidates. Trump beat them both in Florida, a state that has trended red. And yes, because it was a presidential year, he got a lot of votes. But his margin, his victory margin, was 1 point and 3 points, roughly. And he, in raw votes, if he wants to talk about raw votes, he increased from 2016 to 2020, he increased his raw vote total by more than a million. And he increased his margin from 1 point to 3 points, approximately. Ron DeSantis in 2018, yes, with the help of Donald Trump, got himself nominated and elected just barely in a blue wave year, in an anti-Trump backlash election, 2018. DeSantis won by like 32,000 votes, 0.4% in Florida, squeaked through against Andrew Gillum, who the media was promoting every single day. They were big Andrew Gillum fans, which didn't turn out well for them for a number of reasons. 4 years later, 2022, we just went through this. DeSantis won by 1.5 million votes. He increased his raw vote total by almost 1.5 million votes, a better raw vote improvement than Trump made over 4 years. And because of the relative turnout, DeSantis went from 0.4 victory in terms of a percentage point to 19.4 percentage point victory. There's just no comparing which of these performances, 4 years apart, is more impressive. It's just not close. In his 2022 blowout, like almost 20 points, unheard of in Florida, DeSantis flipped blue counties like Miami-Dade County, Palm Beach County, Osceola County, counties that Donald Trump decisively lost twice. DeSantis flipped them. Look at demographics. Trump lost women narrowly in Florida in 2020. DeSantis won them by 7 points. Trump lost Hispanics in Florida in 2020. DeSantis won them by 15 points. Trump lost independents in Florida in 2020 by double digits, 11 points. DeSantis won them by 8 2 years later. Trump got blown out by younger voters in Florida. DeSantis was competitive among younger voters. He won 30 to 44-year-olds. Now, you can make the case, as I did, that Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden are not impressive opponents. They're not strong opponents. Trump beat Hillary and lost to Biden. Now, the flip side could be, well, DeSantis just beat Charlie Crist, this washed-up guy who switched all the parties and he's terrible. I mean, you can actually say that Crist was a very weak opponent, but that's not what Trump has said. Trump has praised Charlie Crist and his popularity in Florida and the job that he did in Florida in a separate shotgun blast of rhetoric against DeSantis, right? In his other fanatical, like he's just like anything up against the wall type thing with Trump. So just a few days ago, he's praising Charlie Crist. So it's hard to then say, well, Crist was a terrible, easy opponent to beat. I mean, if you want to be consistent, which Trump is not really interested in doing. We've already talked about the ludicrous argument that Trump makes that DeSantis was a lockdown governor during COVID. Just phenomenally untrue and particularly rich coming from Trump, who was far too deferential to a guy like Fauci for way too long. No one actually believes that DeSantis is a big lockdown governor, which is what Trump is calling him. I mean, Trump doesn't believe it. Trump doesn't believe a lot of the stuff he's saying about DeSantis, as he admitted the other day in Iowa, where he's attacking DeSantis on ethanol, and then he stopped himself. He said, by the way, if DeSantis doesn't run, I'll tell you he was fine on ethanol. It'll be fine. It won't matter. He doesn't believe this stuff. He's just throwing it out there to whip people up. Maybe it's working. I don't know. Now, when we come back, I want to just examine a few more of the claims that Trump made and shed light on whether they're true or not and bring some actual data to the conversation. If that sounds like something you're interested in hearing, if you're in the market for that, great. Please stay tuned to The Guy Benson Show.
The Guy Benson Show. More next.
We're back. It's The Guy Benson Show. Trump, DeSantis, the whole feud, that's our topic here, at least for this segment. Then I'll move on. But I wanted to set the record straight on a couple things that were claimed and asserted about the state of Florida, because it goes beyond just DeSantis himself. He called Florida, Trump did, among the worst in the nation on education. U.S. News and World Report ranks Florida number 3 in the country overall on education, by far the best performing red state, number 3. Trump says that's among the worst. Florida students scored above the national average, often, quote, significantly higher than the national average in math, reading, and science in last year's nation's report card, partially because they were in school during the pandemic, thanks to the governor, unlike a lot of other places. Trump says that's among the worst. In fact, they're ranked 3rd. Trump says they're like dead last on affordability. U.S. News and World Report ranks Florida average 25th on affordability, cost of living. Wallet Hub says Florida has a top 10 best state and local tax burden, like 6th lowest in the country. Trump describes that as like dead last. Trump says that Florida is among the worst in law and order and crime. In fact, Florida has hit a 50-year low on the crime rate. He's just making this stuff up. And he's doing it for the sole and obvious purpose of attacking someone that he sees as a political threat. Some people like that sort of combative fighting style. A lot of other people don't, including a lot of the people who actually ultimately decide general elections. And if you're a Trump fan, great. If you want Trump to win, fine. There's a case to be made for him. You can make it. He can make it. What I can't just sit by and ignore is dishonesty running down someone else who could be a very good presidential candidate with false attacks, not just attacking him personally, but attacking the record in the state of Florida that matters in terms of proving the success of conservative policy. To diminish that and dismiss it and say it's not real, it's all a mirage for your own selfish political reasons is doing damage not just to Ron DeSantis potentially, but to the broader conservative argument. Make an honest case for yourself. Make an honest case against your opponents. Don't be dishonest this way. That's my point. And I hope conservative voters actually pay attention and actually care about accuracy and truth and other factors like that. Because as I said, there is way too much on the line next year in the election to just sort of be guided by tribal emotions and feelings. We have to be rational and strategic and honest amongst ourselves to have a chance of beating the other side. Because the other side is ruthless and focused, absolutely focused on winning. Because winning matters a lot. You can't do things and govern if you don't win first. So let's have an actual, factual conversation about what it takes to win. Final hour of The Guy Benson Show coming up next. Jerry Willis is here. Looking forward to that conversation straight ahead.
It's 5 o'clock in the most powerful city in the world, Washington, D.C. It's time for The Guy Benson Show Happy Hour, sponsored by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage has come to America. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
is the happy hour on the Guy Benson Show on this Friday. Thanks so much for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com, our website. Podcast is always free on demand when the show is over. That's at GuyBensonShow.com or FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Plus, bonus Benson on the weekends. And I'm just going to underscore, if you missed some of the home stretches this week, you missed a lot, check out Bonus Benson. That's tomorrow. GuyBensonShow.com with a free podcast. Follow us on social media at Guy Benson Show on Twitter and Instagram. You can follow me there as well. Both of those places at Guy P. Benson. This hour brought to you, as always, by the Finnish Long Drink, our good friends over there. I will probably indulge in at least one this evening. We'll talk about that, as a matter of fact, at the end of the hour. Celebrating a certain occasion, perhaps. Stay tuned for that. Always drink responsibly. 21 plus only, of course. TheLongDrink.com. TheLongDrink.com. Well, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Jerry Willis, Fox business reporter and anchor, also host of the brand new podcast, The Fearless and Proud Podcast at FoxNewsPodcast.com. Here's a little taste, cut 26.
The Fearless and Proud podcast series looks at acts of bravery and strength by women. And in this first season, we look at women who played important roles in the Civil War. Subscribe and listen now at FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jerry Willis, great to have you. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Great to hear from you and excited to talk about the podcast.
Absolutely. So you gave us a little preview there in the promo that we played about what you're focused on, at least with this installment of your new podcast, Fearless and Proud. Tell us a little bit more about it and maybe some of the stories that you unearthed and share with the audience.
Sure. I'm so excited to put this thing out. We're really looking at women during the Civil War who served as soldiers, as spies, as battlefield nurses. Now, the reason this might be so surprising and interesting is because, remember, 150 years ago, women couldn't wear pants walking the streets, much less fight in combat. You would get arrested or you might be fined for wearing pants. The result of all this was that it was kind of easy for women to pass as male soldiers because anytime a person saw somebody in pants, they just naturally assumed they were a fella. So women who, you know, maybe they were motivated by money, they wanted to make more money, so they became soldiers. It was difficult for women to earn a lot of dough then. Or maybe it was love, you know, they're following their husband into combat or maybe a brother or even their father. And some of them were just patriots. You know, they were signed on to a side, whether it was that of the Union, the Federalists, or the Confederacy as rebels. We saw women on both sides of the fighting lines in that. And, of course, we talk a lot about really famous people like Harriet Tubman and the surprising things she did, not just on the Underground Railroad, but working as a Union spy and leading Union soldiers. We also talk about people you've probably never heard about, Elizabeth Van Loo. She was a spy in the capital of the Confederacy, Richmond, Virginia, and she was representing Union interests.
Wow. So tell us a little bit more about her, because I'm really intrigued by spy stuff. Obviously, if you are near the corridors of power and you're down in Richmond at that period of time, obviously, if you get caught, it's the end for you. What did she do and what was she able to accomplish in terms of helping the Union?
So Elizabeth Van Loo was a wealthy lady, and she used all of her ladyhood to get information about people she had known for a very long time who were now running the levers of power in the Confederate government. She even managed to put one of her own former slaves into the White House of the Confederacy as a servant for Jefferson Davis. And this woman read Davis's desk, read plans, and gave the information back to the Union. So Elizabeth Van Loo was very cunning, very secretive, really good at weaseling out information from people. And plus, she bribed a few folks in government to get some of the troop movements that were being planned. So she had a big ring of spies that worked for her and fed her information. And it was said late in the war, she could get her reports directly to the battlefield desk of General Grant, along with flowers from her farm and the Richmond's daily newspaper, a copy of that.
Wow. I mean, that's just really interesting stuff. One of these gems of our history that you uncover and you talk about in this new podcast, Jerry Willis and the Fearless and Proud podcast. What was the research process like for this? Because I know that this is a realm that gets some attention, maybe not as much as it should, but you want to bring these stories and bring fresh eyes to the stories. How did you decide, you know, which women to profile, which stories were compelling enough? What was the production and research process combined really look like? What did it look like for this podcast?
So this really started for me during COVID. I was looking for a way to inspire young women I knew who were having a hard time getting motivated, who were, you know, disturbed by what was going on in society with COVID, the fact that they were having to stay home with mom and dad, or they were home with the kids and having to, you know, educate them themselves. They were under a lot of pressure. So I was looking for really inspirational women. And I thought, you know, women in American history have done so many cool things. Let's go find cool women. And I stepped into the whole Civil War era, and I was blown away by the number of women who did amazing things decades and decades and decades before anybody ever thought of the word feminism. These ladies were making it happen every day. Now, for the podcast, we interviewed six historians. We had 6 hours of tape. And it was an absolute joy. John Toldy, my producer, and I just had a great time talking to these folks about these women and about the trends, how these women did what they did, what it took, really, the grit, the determination. Remember, they were really marching to the sound of their own drummer. There was nobody saying, hey, you need to enlist, or wouldn't it be a great idea? Nobody said that to them. They all did it under their own steam.
All right, because I think a lot of people, just men, frankly, overlooked them, right? And it's like, okay, you're not even part of this conversation, so of course no one's telling them to do these things. They took their own initiative, and maybe that was actually one of the advantages, especially when it comes to spycraft, right? Because people and men of that era would just dismiss women out of hand, like, oh, there's a woman here, almost like she's an, or in the case of a slave, like not even a person, not to be worried about it all. We can just talk openly and leave things out because they're just, you know, they're just slaves. They're just women. And that was a huge strategic mistake on their part, and therefore made people who fit those profiles potentially very effective spies.
Exactly right. And, you know, women, you know, they secreted information in their massive flowing dresses. They would put them in their the way they put their hair up. They would put notes and other stolen pieces of information in their hair designs. I mean, they were really creative when it got right down to it. Some women stole battlefield plans. Some women were out there stealing things that were really needed in society in the South or the North. They would go across the line. I mean, look, you know, the border was porous, and everybody had relations on both sides. You know, it was very common for somebody in your family to be fighting the other side of the war. So it's hard for people to understand what that was like today. But by definition, for example, at the time, if you lived in the South, you were involved in the war pretty much because it was going on right outside your kitchen window, and ignoring it was almost impossible.
Well, this is a perfect podcast for Women's History Month, which is March, and you can check out the Fearless and Proud podcast with Jerry Willis at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your podcast. Now, Jerry, as I mentioned in your intro, you've been with Fox Business for years, reporter, anchor. You follow our economy and the markets very closely. So I do want to ask you about just some of this upheaval on Wall Street. More concerns about banks. We saw Deutsche Bank, some worries about that bubbling to the fore today. It seemed like maybe some of this stuff was over and behind us and it was all very contained. And then, You know, you get a report about this bank or that bank. Maybe this isn't really over. How long could this keep going, and where does this go from here?
So I think the only thing I can tell you with certainty is it's not over yet. And the problem is we don't know how this is going to play out for many of the banks throughout the world, right? As you know, a problem in Europe can reverberate here in the U.S. of A. And financial markets, we're all connected. So that's what concerns me. And seeing Deutsche Bank, which is thought of as kind of a Gibraltar of banks, having problems on this score is surprising. Right now, the focus is what you call credit swap defaults, CDS, credit default swaps. These are, just think of this as an insurance policy for bonds on corporations and especially banks right now. That's what's having problems. Right now, nobody wants to issue that. Who wants to be in the business of insurance, insuring bank bonds? Nobody. And it's creating a lot of concerns in the marketplace, especially as the stocks of these banks dive. And some of them are gobbled up by bigger banks, and they're forced to have that happen by regulators. So I think it's not over. I know there's a lot of optimism. Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, saying today, don't look here. It's over. We're getting better now. But I think you're really going to have to think twice, certainly, before buying bank stocks. But also, if you're close to retirement, it's time to just chill, do nothing, and wait this out. Don't make any massive decisions right now, either cashing out your investments or choosing something to put down a lot of money on while this thing plays out, because we really don't know where it's going.
Jerry, what did you make this week of the Fed's actions and then Powell's comments as well? Wall Street Journal has a story about this tightrope that the Fed is trying to walk, inflation on one side, bank turmoil on the other. I described this a week or two ago as sort of a pick your poison moment, where if you're trying to fight inflation with aggressive action at the Fed and hiking rates here, that then has knock-on effects in other places, including some of these banks. And we've seen those jitters and affecting the markets as well. As you saw Powell and the Fed make some moves and some statements this week, what's your reaction? What's your analysis?
So I feel like the Fed sort of lost control here, because they're damned if they do, damned if they don't, as you just described. I think they were sort of forced into this 25 basis point cut. Why? They needed to do the quarter point, because if they did nothing, if they sat and put no interest rate increase in effect, that could be telling the market we're really worried about banks, and that would cause a sell-off, right? So they did the least that they could do, which is the 25 basis point rate hike,
right?
Or rate cut or rate hike.
But without doing nothing, right? They're doing something, not doing nothing, but it's sort of the bare minimum. They're trying to send a lot of signals to different constituencies, it feels like.
Absolutely. And they serve a lot of constituencies. The problem is that you don't know how this is going to reverberate to banks. And there's the complicating factor of commercial real estate right now, which is also getting hammered by this. This rate hike series, I believe we've had 9 rate hikes, has stung some players like nothing else. Of course, the banks now seeing problems. But commercial real estate is really having difficulty, and we've seen this movie before. It's been some time, but it doesn't end well. And I worry that this is going to throw us into a recession at the end of the year. And of course, as you know, Wall Street is projecting possible recession at the end of the year or the beginning of the next, so fourth quarter or first quarter next year. So we continue to wait and watch. This reminds me a lot of 2008, 2007, when every day we got another headline. It is not as bad as that yet. Be rest assured. You know,
I remember that well. It felt different. It felt a lot worse. It has not been good here recently, but it's not there. Hopefully it will not get there. But a lot of people are watching with slightly anxious eyes on, you know, what shoe might drop next. And they've got you covered at Fox Business, where you can watch Jerry Willis all the time. Also catch her Fearless and Proud podcast, as we mentioned, aligning with Women's History Month at foxnewspodcast.com. Jerry, so appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Guy. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
We will step aside. We'll come back. It's the happy hour on this Friday. It's the Guy Benson Show.
Fresh conservative talk. Guy Benson Show.
Back here on the Happy Hour, the Guy Benson Show. March Madness in full swing. The Sweet 16 kicking off, or I should say tipping off, last night. A couple different locations. Madison Square Garden and Las Vegas. Not bad venues, actually, either one of them. And some really good games last night. The blowout was UConn beating Arkansas. Like, not even close. Just a drubbing from start to finish. So the fourth seed Huskies move on. Then you had an upset, the ninth seeded FAU Owls, I believe, beating Tennessee at Madison Square Garden in New York. So those two teams, UConn and FAU, move on, survive, advance to the Elite Eight. And then the games of the night. I don't know which one was better. They were both so good. I would say Kansas State, Michigan State was probably the best game as the first game of the evening. Kansas State won in overtime, 98-93, including a bucket at the buzzer to seal the win. But Michigan State battled back late in regulation. It was nip and tuck back and forth the whole way. Michigan State tied it, forced overtime, and guys were just hitting huge clutch shots at both ends of the floor. It was a very fun, exciting college basketball game, played at a very high level. And I know one of the guards for Kansas State, I think, set an NCAA tournament record for assists. I'm just absurd. One of them was an alley-oop reverse jam thrown up in overtime. And I was rooting for Michigan State because the Big Ten connection there, and Tom Izzo's a great coach, but ultimately the Purple Wildcats, the other Purple Wildcats, other than my own Northwestern Wildcats, prevailed. And now the Big Ten eliminated totally from the tournament. All eight teams gone before the Elite Eight. And then the late game was UCLA and Gonzaga. And UCLA had a big lead in this one. And then the Bulldogs came storming back, took the lead, went up by 10 with like 2 minutes left. And then the Zags sort of almost choked it away. UCLA came back, tied the game, took the lead, and then a crazy shot by Gonzaga, not quite midcourt, but like from the March Madness logo at midcourt, buried a three, won the game in Vegas, and so the Bruins are now out. So just two instant classic games yesterday, and then of course there's four games tonight. San Diego State, Alabama, Miami, Houston, Princeton, the underdogs against Creighton, and then Xavier in Texas, and we'll have the Elite Eight finalized ahead of the weekend after this evening. Love this time of year, and if you're a sports fan, you know exactly what I'm talking about. The Guy Benson Show Happy Hour, back after this.
You're listening to a new generation of talk, Guy Benson.
Happy Hour on this Friday on The Guy Benson Show. In our first hour today, Shannon Bream stopped by. She is the anchor of Fox News Sunday. I'll be on that program this weekend. Always fun with Shannon. Here's part of my conversation with her. And the book coming out on Tuesday, yes. As I mentioned, just a few days away. Just want to give us a little summary real quick. I know your first two installments of this series have done very well.
Yeah.
Tell us about this one.
So, you know, a lot of what we hear about romance and about marriage, people think, the Bible's not really the place I'm going to go for that. But there's actually a lot there. There are beautiful stories of sacrifice. And we think about Mary and Joseph and Ruth and Boaz. And there's some really good ones. There's some messes like Samson and Delilah. But you know me, if you've read any of my books, you know I like to keep the messy ones in there, too, because I think there are lessons. But I do talk about friendship and this tricky part of the Bible that says you have to love your neighbor as yourself, and there are no exceptions. So I think given the current climate, we could all do more of that.
I would agree. And as you were arriving in the studio, I was just talking a little bit about this breaking news, a death threat against Alvin Bragg, and then this meme that Trump had posted on Truth Social with the baseball bat and the death and destruction language. And it's just like, look, it's frustrating to me because I think on the merits, it's a very bad look for Bragg. He might have a problem with his grand jurors at this point. It's helping Trump. And if you're a Trump fan, you just want to be like, just, you know, stand back and let some of this play out. And then when you start talking about some of this violent language, and then this happens, and the threat and the calls for protest. There are some images that crop mm-hmm. up from 2021, mm-hmm. and it just seems – to me, it just seems self-destructive. I know a lot of people love that Trump fights, but there's smart fighting, and then there's mm-hmm. something other than that, and this seems – totally unnecessarily counterproductive.
Yeah, don't give your critics ammo because they're going to have plenty anyway. They're going to look for things and find things. So when they expect you to say something like, yeah, get out there and protest and there might be, quote, death and destruction and the baseball bat meme, I mean, none of that stuff is good for you. Like you said, I think this is probably among the weakest legal cases for him. And based on the testimony of Robert Costello last week, the 2018 letter from Michael Cohen that's popped up, I mean, the grand jury seems to be on a bit of a pause. We don't know what goes on. It's a secret proceeding.
Right.
But it appears it was moving in a positive direction, potentially for the president, former president. So when you do all these other things, the good news for you gets lost in the shuffle because immediately your critics are going to think of January 6th. They're going to go back to all of those places. And maybe it's that, listen, he is a monster in the polls. He is killing it. He is killing the field. And so he may just be feeling very confident that, you know, what did he say in his first campaign for the presidency that, you know, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and still win. People would vote for me. Maybe that's what he's feeling these days.
Yeah, except he lost his most recent election.
Well, I should say, I think that was his first campaign.
It was.
But he did win.
I'm saying, you know, that it's not – the country is not so enamored of him that they will vote for him no matter what because
right.
they had an opportunity to vote for him for reelection after a pretty good presidency in a lot mm-hmm. of ways. And they picked this other guy who's I talked about at the start of the show instead. So just
– take your wins where you can get them.
Yeah.
I would say that to any candidate. Take your wins where you can get them.
Right, and don't shoot yourself in the foot. Speaking of mm-hmm. shooting someone, don't just fire it into your own toes
yeah. mm-hmm.
totally unnecessarily. I do have to say, though, because you were talking about the weakness of this case in New mm-hmm. York, and it's one of three or four cases out mm-hmm. there potentially against Trump. I saw that, I guess, weighing in from prison
right.
is Michael Avenatti.
Oh, man.
Who's saying that Michael Cohen,
right.
Trump's longtime sort of hatchet man, lawyer, body
These
guy.
These two guys.
They're like, Avenatti from prison is saying that Michael Cohen's a hack and terrible and not credible and all this stuff, which I think is true, but
well,
consider the source.
Right, exactly.
Avenatti
this is a man
here.
Who's going to be behind bars for a long time for
yep.
his own problems with
yep.
veracity. But yeah, and I think he's really getting at Alvin Bragg, as many on the left are saying, like, listen, you can't pin this whole case on Cohen because either he was lying then or he's lying now. That could raise some doubt in the grand jurors' minds. And you got to weigh that. You don't want to build your entire indictment of Trump on somebody that, listen, when he gets on the witness stand, could be impeached as a witness. There are going to be, listen, whoever's defending
well,
President Trump.
All the guy's done is lie forever. Michael Cohen. It's like
either one way or the other. I mean, he's been lying then or lying now. I mean, that's a provable fact.
Or some of both, right? It seems
yeah,
like,
you can't be telling the truth in all these cases. So if the president is indicted, if he faces a trial, his defense team is going to have a field day with Michael Cohen. And that's why so many on the left are like, don't do this, Alvin Bragg, because if you tee this thing up, don't get a prosecution, it's going to look totally political.
Because it is, right?
You don't get a conviction, yeah.
Or even if they... The indictment itself would be political. I mean, the feds, mm-hmm. who are more than
yeah,
happy
they said
to
no
go
thanks.
Out, they said no thanks based on the facts, mm-hmm. based on the evidence or lack thereof. And again, this is why, coming back to the point, I think at least on this case, things were moving mm-hmm. in a very uncomfortable direction for Alvin Bragg and maybe even the Democrats, and a favorable one for Trump for a number of reasons, because he's in the spotlight, people are rallying to him, which is why he's got this lead in the polls right now. And it's just like – the self-destructive impulse to then just go that extra step or two farther, mm-hmm. which some people will absolutely love. The hardcore mm-hmm. base of Trump will love that sort of thing. That's why they love him. But a lot of other people will say, dude, what are you doing?
Like, and it reminds them of listen, even if they loved his policies toward the end of that first term, how they were getting so frustrated with having to defend him all the time and feeling like he was snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. So I do think it will remind some people who are like, yeah, I could, you know, I'd love to have him back. I could deal with some of his policies. I love those. I love the judges, whatever. But I didn't want to deal with all of the chicanery that came along with that. And mm-hmm. he's reminding them now, listen, I can, like you said, for some people who are huge Trump supporters, they love this. This is what gets their fire going, and it's why they're absolutely going to vote for him again.
My full interview with Fox News Sunday anchor Shannon Bream, available at GuyBensonShow.com. Also, the free podcast, every day, the whole show, on demand, start to finish, totally free. plus bonus Benson on the weekends. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we return, it's the home stretch. It's a national holiday to some extent. It's like Cookie's personal holiday. We'll tell you what that means and have a little discussion about it right after this.
For the full interview and more, go to GuyBensonShow.com.
Home stretch. Happy Friday on the Guy Benson Show, GuyBensonShow.com, our website, podcast free all the time, on demand, no charge. Bonus Benson on the weekends, always a big hit as well. If you missed any of the home stretches this week, you're going to want to catch up on Bonus Benson. Just trust me. You missed a lot. There's a lot of content. Some fascinating dynamics. GuyBensonShow.com. As I mentioned, I'll be on Fox News Sunday morning. Check your local listings. Excited for that. Now, meanwhile, today, appropriately on a Friday, it is National Cocktail Day. And I will openly admit that I am very ready for a cocktail or three tonight. I have been away from home so much. I've been traveling. Tomorrow will be my first day off. No work, no travel in a little over 4 weeks. And I can't wait. And in anticipation of that time off tomorrow, we're going over to the neighbor's house. We'll probably have a couple cocktails in the evening in honor of National Cocktail Day. Our neighbor Scott makes a mean gin and tonic, so I'll probably just stick with that. That's my go-to at his place. My favorite cocktail is a Gold Rush, especially when it's colder out the winter months. It's a bourbon-based cocktail. Actually, speaking of cocktails, do you know what I got delivered to my home a few days ago? A brand new bourbon that is a John Taffer branded bourbon. John Taffer of Bar Rescue, who's been on this show, he's got this like butter bourbon. And I was on Gutfeld with him a few weeks ago. He said, "Hey, do you like bourbon?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Would you like to try my new bourbon?" I said, "Yes." So I got a bottle of the new bourbon. We might bring that over to Scott's house, Scott and Veronica tonight. That could be fun. So just sort of relax, have a bite of dinner with Adam, go over there and just chill with a handful of cocktails. And I was about to talk about the Gold Rush, a bourbon-based cocktail, probably my favorite. I've mentioned that before. And not only is it National Cocktail Day and something that I'm personally interested in this evening, it's also a topic that, of course, we have to ask Christine about, given her habits. Let's put it that way. And as you might know, she's a big vodka gal, or she would call it a vodka girl. Her favorite cocktail for a long time has been the Cosmo. And this is setting aside Mama's Juice, which is what we generally just call wine for her. She's a Cosmo gal, which is the bright pink vodka-based beverage that from a young age her daughter identifies with her mother. Right? This is something that Christine has told us multiple times on the air. I'm not making this up. But Christine is starting to have some, I don't know, some second thoughts. She's wavering a little bit on the Cosmo. Christine, explain this existential crisis that you're undergoing at the moment.
So I've been doing some major research. And by research, I mean housewives watching. And what I've learned, I didn't know if you know this, but the older you get, sometimes some liquor and even some wines kind of turn on you. And you can't really consume it like you used to. Like, I know some people that, like, can no longer drink red wine or no more can drink a white wine. I'm starting to worry that the Cosmo and especially, which it breaks my heart, vodka is turning on poor Cody.
Vodka's turning on you, Christine?
Mm-hmm. I think it's time that we have to break up. But
whoa.
With that being said, I still need a cocktail. And I just love, for some reason, I am obsessed with drinking out of martini glasses. Like anything that can come in some like sort of like goblet or the real martini glass, that's what I want to drink out of. And I know you can only have certain drinks that go in there. So if there's anybody that can recommend something.
Well, you could just ask the bartender, can you please put this drink in a martini glass?
It has to be a martini, though, of some sort. I can't. I'm very strict with glassware. Like red wine has to be in a certain in red wine glasses. White wine has to. I would never drink champagne out of like a wine glass. No,
really.
I'm very proper that way. I know
you of all people are picky over glassware.
Very. One time, a waitress brought me a Cosmo in not a martini glass, and I asked her to take it back. I wasn't going to drink it without a martini glass.
Don't you have like 12 different flasks?
Well, flasks are a whole different thing. That's kind of when you just like
different category,
whatever kind of hooch you can get at the time.
Okay, got it. So you're in the market for a new cocktail, a new go-to cocktail. Are you moving away from vodka completely? Are you thinking about maybe the tequila space, God forbid, potentially? Like, what are you thinking here?
I don't know. Can you imagine Cookie, like, really revved up on tequila?
Yes.
You could. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I have to. This is a lot to process, and this is a lot to think about. So I'm not going to just, you know, I don't know if you know this about me, but I take my time when I'm making decisions. I don't just rush into things. I research.
Yes, calm, cool, collected. That's our cookie. Well, here's a thought. Wyatt was telling us that Wyatt has started to very much enjoy a new discovery in the cocktail space recently. So maybe this will give you a lead to carefully consider. I almost said it in a sober way, but I mean, LOL. Wyatt, what have you been trying recently?
So it's not a cocktail, but it was a beer, a Guinness, because of St. Patrick's Day. Oh. I had a few Guinnesses and they were pretty good. It's like a meal. It's like a but it's pretty good. I was kind of surprised I liked it because I don't really like certain kinds of beers, but it was pretty good.
I dissent. It's way too thick, way too heavy, way too dark for me. I've had it. I've had a sip of it. I had it in Ireland because you do it. I am much more of a lighter beer type guy. But I also, again, I could be wrong, but I kind of know Christine well enough after all these years. I'm not sure she's going to make the switch from a Cosmo to a Guinness. That seems like that's about as far apart as you can get while still remaining alcohol.
It's just that's not going to happen. I don't like Guinness. I mean, like you said, if I was in Ireland, sure, I'd have a Guinness. Or I don't even know if I'd have it on St. Patty's Day. That is a heavy, heavy beer.
Give me a sip of Guinness.
That's not – no, I want a cocktail. Like I really – if anybody wants to tweet at me, Cookies Jar 1988, give me some new ideas of something that's not vodka-based that I can put in a martini glass.
All right, and here's you can't Christine. Just tell me here's what you got to do. You've got to tweet out soliciting this advice. Tag me in it. I will retweet it, and we will see what the internet decides to bring you.
This is exciting. This is very exciting. I'm so happy we're talking about this.
It could be a new dawn, a new day for producer Christine. We're not talking about mediums at all or psychics. We're talking about booze. Nope. It's very much her comfort zone. Now, on the topic of cocktails – Dan, as we mentioned yesterday, just got back from a vacation in Florida. And while in Florida, something very exciting and very on brand for us happened to Dan. This is absolutely true. This is not product placement. Dan, tell us what happened.
Well, so I'm not much of a mixed drinker myself. I usually go for the light beer. So I was down in Florida. We were staying with my girlfriend's best friend. And usually she has gets our beer, what we want when we get down there, and we all have some drinks and whatever. So we get to her apartment and she goes, "Hey guys, check this out. I got this new great gin type drink. You have to try it. Go to the fridge and grab one." So I go over to her fridge and I open up the fridge and lo and behold, there's a beautiful red can and it is the finished long drink cranberry.
Yes. Yes.
And so I was so excited to see it in there. I grabbed one. I go, "How do you know about finished long drink?" And she goes, "How do you know about finished long drink?" And I explained to her that they're a sponsor of the Guy Benson Show.
It's
and
happy
and we drank them and it was fantastic.
Deeply offended that she was not aware of that.
I know, me too.
I mean, this is your livelihood, Dan, but it's awesome that she has come to the long drink on her own.
She loves it.
And no, it's got a huge and growing fan base. Like in all seriousness, we talk about this. I saw they tweeted out not that long ago, Long Drink did from their official account. How did you learn about the Long Drink? And there were a number of people in the replies saying it's a Guy Benson show, Guy Benson's podcast. It's like, yes, we are getting the word out for our great sponsor. I will almost certainly have one at least tonight. I like the cranberry one more as a mixer, whereas I drink the OG blue can or the white can, which is my favorite, just as a standalone beverage. But to each his or her own. And I love the fact that you encountered it in the wild and that your girlfriend's best friend was like mystified. Was she almost like excited to learn that you have this real connection to this beverage?
Well,
or was she mad that she didn't get to like be the one to discover it for you?
She was kind of mad that she didn't get to be the one to discover it. She was like, she wanted to be like, hey, guys, I found this new cool thing. Like, you know, this is really a really good new drink.
Like, yeah, I was in on the ground floor. So, we were in on the ground floor.
A little bit of a one-upper on that situation I was, but
well done.
Right.
I mean, but you earned that. I think we deserved that. And you all enjoyed it is the point. We should probably clip this and send it to the sponsor. Just to be like, we worked it in. But again, it's absolutely true. And it's National Cocktail Day, so come on. All right, so we have Christine casting about for a new option other than Cosmos because she might be moving away from vodka. We've got Wyatt discovering his love for Guinness, which is a surprising development, I have to say. We've got Dan in the Sunshine State enjoying Long Drink. We've got yours truly getting ready for an actual day off tomorrow, and cocktails will be involved. Good topic. Good talk, guys. Fun times. Have a great weekend. See you on Fox News Sunday, back here on the radio Monday for the Guy Benson Show.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.